There's little things we can teach our children and the young people we work with in particular. So if we're walking along, I might just go up to someone and say, do you mind if I stroke your dog? Just to show them that actually it's okay to talk to people. Obviously the stranger danger thing still exists, but at the same time is reading someone's body language and understanding when they're safe to approach. And when you walk past someone that might be fishing on a river or a lake and going, oh, how are you, mate? Have you caught anything today? And that might change someone's day because they might have not spoke to anyone all day or all week because we are so isolated now. Yeah. That, for me, makes a huge impact on these young people because they start treating their friends a little bit better. They start being a bit more respectful to teachers because they realise actually shaking someone's hand and going, hi, Paul, how are you, mate? How's things been? Goes a long way. Sometimes it's just being a good role model.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefull. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hey guys, great to see you again on This Is Powerful. Today, I am pleased to welcome a great guy who is doing incredible work with vulnerable young people, getting them re-engaged with school and with the world at large. Tom Padgett is the operations lead for Reach Group Community Projects based in Essex, delivering bespoke projects and mentoring pathways to engage the most vulnerable young people in the country. Reach Group uses a blend of proven methodologies and physical activity to help those that have been pushed to the wayside for various reasons. Tom uses his life experience to successfully support the next generation through his guidance as a boxing coach, and as a life-changing mentor. Tom Padgett, welcome to This Is Powerful.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming in, mate. For those who don't live in London, it's quite a commute, right, in the mornings?
Yeah, those trains are carnage.
It's absolutely like a wrestling match to get here.
Yeah, I couldn't do it every day, definitely not.
Tom, you're operations lead for Reach Group Community Projects in Essex. You also won an award, didn't you, last year for Physical Activity Champion of the Year Award for Activity Awards at Active Essex.
Yeah, I did,
which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I know you do a lot of work. We spoke quite a bit. And you do very meaningful work, actually, with the community. Before we get into that, I'd love to know a bit about you, so where you're from and your background.
Yeah, so obviously, Tom, I grew up in Gravesend, Kent, and then moved to Essex. Single parent background, so my mum moved us to a nicer, more rural part of the world just to try and keep me and my brother out of trouble, essentially, as parents do. They make
was that before
decisions.
You was getting in trouble or during?
Just as we'd started. yeah, so she could kind of see how difficult it was going to be to bring up two boys on her own with very little income and decided to move us to a rural part of Essex.
How old was you there?
I was just going into secondary school when that happened, so quite a transitional part of my life, I suppose. So making new friends and all that sort of stuff. I'm a bit of a loner anyway, so I think I quite like my own time, so I didn't find it too difficult. But
quite a difficult transaction, even from going from, I remember, from junior school to senior school in the same area. I found that quite difficult.
Yeah, I found it baffling, really, because I came from quite a diverse area. So you're used to seeing all different walks of life. To go into a very sort of middle-class part of Essex was quite a transition. I couldn't quite work out why it was majority middle-class white people being dropped off to school in their Range Rovers, but I soon transitioned, started speaking properly. But yeah, no, generally it was probably the best thing that could have happened to me. There was very few opportunities where we were living before, so I'm grateful for that move, I suppose, in hindsight. And then it was really just all about sport. I was quite academic, but I suppose I was quite lazy at school, and I found it difficult to engage in education in the normal format. I've got ADHD, so for me, sitting in a classroom for 5-6 hours a day can be quite challenging. Yeah. I was always a good kid, got my head down, didn't really get in any trouble in school. I just found it challenging at times.
Did you get diagnosed early with ADHD?
No, I've been diagnosed as an adult. I was always knew, not different's the wrong word, but I always knew that there was something a little bit there that got in the way sometimes. I found it difficult to sit still. I found it difficult to to listen a lot of the time. So when I was having sort of someone reading from a textbook to me in a classroom, which is another subject we'll go into later, but I found it quite difficult not to zone out. I think it was a bit of a defence mechanism. So that was me. So as I got older, I decided to go to the GP and get that diagnosis. I've never been medicated for it, but it was definitely something that's helped because I've started to understand my brain a little bit better.
That's quite an awareness as a young person to know you're a bit different, right?
Yeah.
Did you talk about that with your mum or...?
Yeah, so I suppose... she could never get me to do homework or anything like that. My brain was exhausted by the time I left school. So she was thought I was just lazy. But that wasn't the case because I was playing sport 7 days a week. But I noticed a difference when I was being physical as to when I was stagnant and sat in a classroom. Sport, I loved it. I felt like I could release when I was on a football pitch or in a boxing gym or on a rugby pitch, whatever it was, I'd try and turn my hand to it. I always say that I was good at everything, but great at nothing, really. But yeah, for me, that was kind of my release. But yeah, classroom situation was really difficult. I think that's probably led to what I do now to try and help those young people in those similar situations.
It's quite a foreign thing, isn't it? I look at my kids. I mean, I've not been diagnosed with ADHD, but I bet you I'll get 10 out of 10.
Yeah, 100%.
I was the same. I was a bright kid, but on the reports, I was, if he focused, it'd always say, if he focused, he'd be okay. Yeah. And the same thing, couldn't focus. The only time I focused is if I really liked the teacher and they engaged with me and they saw who I was, and I would make an extra effort for them, not for myself. I had a teacher called Mr. Bowles. He was quite an odd fellow. He like had long, straggly hair, always wore blue and brown shoes, probably that's what we've got on today, but he had the same outfit every day. And he was really hyper-intelligent. He was really a really caring guy, but he just got ripped by the kids because of how he wore and dressed, right? And he generally didn't care. But he got diagnosed with cancer 1 year, and my mum had been ill prior. And I had this 1 minute with him. And I really empathised with him and he was quite stoic and made a conversation. And from that moment, I moved from the back of class to the front and actually got to the top of class in my English, which was not what anyone thought, but it was because of him.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important, that when you have someone you can engage in, that makes you want to try better, right?
I think if you speak to anyone, there was always that teacher that got them, that understood them, and that makes a huge difference. I did really well in history. My history teacher was mad about sport, but like for American history, he made us watch Forrest Gump because he knew that the kids would learn more from that than him standing there for six hours talking to us.
That's so actually smart.
He was thinking outside the box, and I like that. But he was also the energy that he brought to the classroom. He probably definitely has something wrong with him. I mean, like he'd be standing at the front chucking his pen round. Funnily enough, we've gone back to that school with our organisation. He's still there. And I had a good conversation with him and sort of thanked him for the way he was. And he's not changed 20 years later, which is
nice,
great.
Isn't it?
So, I think everyone's got that teacher, haven't we? You see that video of Ian Wright where he goes back to his PE teacher. And that connection between someone that's teaching and someone that's learning is so important. I think it's forgot about a lot of the time.
Yeah, because in my experience, I think you're all addressed as one. And there's so much diversity and difference between children. And it's difficult for the teachers because I think they're probably underpaid, they're stressed. But if you have that engagement, it's awesome, isn't it? So I thinking outside the box and just getting a personal touch with kids can really bring them to life,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that just taking an interest in that young person makes a huge difference. We all know the education system hasn't changed since the Victorian ages. We're still facing the front. We're still reading from textbooks. We're still working off a board. Not a lot's changed, but kids are so different now. And that's kind of where we come in, really, I suppose, with our organisation, is to try and recognise the young person in a holistic way and look at them in a bigger picture, really.
So can you tell us a bit, I'd like to touch on your sports as well, but can you tell us how you got into what you do, how you formed the company, and what work you do?
Yeah, so I like to say I'm one of the co-founders. The guy that calls himself the founder probably wouldn't say. To be fair, he's one of the best men I've ever met. He's given me a great opportunity later in life. What he does for young people and the group of organisations he runs is awesome. Really, really great. But in 2009, 2020, something like that. I was working with him, so he was running the outreach program for the school that I was leading at the time.
And the company's called Reach that he started.
Yeah,
right?
So we're part of a group of organisations called Reach Group. So we're Reach Group Community Projects, which I suppose is the charitable arm of the organisation, I suppose, or the group of organisations. We are set up as a community interest company, looking to go as a charity next year. And he came to me and just said, listen, I'm looking at setting up something because we've noticed a gap in the market. There's loads of kids that are looked after during term time, but during those school holidays are forgotten about. And that's probably when they're most vulnerable because they're at home in with parents that might be abusive. They might be being neglected at home. They might be environments near where they live, which is fueled by gangs, drugs, various other things.
Yeah.
So for him, he saw something that he wanted to put back into the community. I wasn't in a position to come and run the organisation at the time. I'd just had a baby, various other things, and he was looking for someone part-time. So he took on someone part-time who did an okay job, sort of getting it started, but didn't really have that passion there, I suppose, that we've got now within the organisation.
Yeah.
And then it was, I suppose, chance, fluke, whatever you want to call it. But we met up for a coffee. We hadn't spoke to each other in a long time. He'd stopped doing the outreach at the school. Various things happened. And he said, do you fancy a coffee? Let's have a catch up, just on a mate's level. And we sat there, had about four black coffees in a coffee shop. And he basically put in front of me a job description and said, listen, I've given it a go with someone part time, but I really want to make it work. And I want you to run the organisation going forward. So I took it on at that point, basically said, yeah, I'm going to hammer notice in and go. So the following September in 2023, I took on the organisation. It's just me sat in an office with a load of people I didn't really know, with a load of ideas in my head, as we all do when we start businesses. And now two and a half years down the line, we're really flying. I suppose the mission statement for us is to create bespoke projects in the holidays. That was what we set out to do, but it's got bigger than that. We're now providing mentoring in schools for young people. Probably the base level would be, like we spoke about, kids that can't concentrate and engage appropriately in school, all the way to kids that are about to get permanently excluded from school, to kids that have been permanently excluded, to kids that are involved in county lines, kids that are involved in antisocial behaviour on a regular basis. And what we're seeing now is we've gone from a small pond of fish to a massive ocean full of fish, because there's so many more kids that are struggling with education now.
And is this still in the boundaries of Essex?
Yeah, still within the boundaries of Essex. We've got young people that are on roll at schools in Essex that live in other counties, so Suffolk, Kent, Hertfordshire. But at the moment, we're just in Essex. We kind of want to conquer our own kingdom before we start.
I mean, Essex is a huge county.
Exactly, yeah. And the thing is, a lot of people don't understand Essex either, because you see what you see on TV, and it's the nightclubs and the Prosecco and all that other stuff, which probably gives an unhealthy aspect of Essex. But actually, it's a really huge county that's got a lot of rural deprivation as well as urban deprivation as well.
Yeah.
So there are kids that don't have any transport links, and mum doesn't drive, and then you've got the opposite end of it where you go into your greys of the world, and it's a real sort of diverse area that's got a lot of issues. Not so much your London postcode stuff, but more around deprivation and crime.
Yeah.
And then you look at Clacton and Tendring, and you've got Jaywick, which is the most deprived postcode in the whole of the country for the fourth year running.
Is it really?
So you go there and it's a different world. We're working with a lot of kids in that area, and we work with a lot of organisations around there that are giving good opportunities.
When I was younger, there was a whole thing around mindset. So I was brought up in the 70s, right? And there was a lot. We were in a decent area, but there was a lot of areas around where there was gangs. It was a lot of football violence, and there was a lot of knife crime, actually. The mentality was, we were not going to have the opportunities others have, so what's the point?
Yeah.
And I think that was quite a narrative for the school. I think at the time, in the 70s, it was quite depressing anyway. But I think there was a really strong, I lived between a very wealthy area and a pretty poor bit. And I had friends from both. And it was really about the mindset. Mm-hmm. And really generational, like, we're not going to do well, so what's the point? And I think it's really sad, because the people I know that came from the poorer side that saw a bit of hope or saw something have done really, really, really well. Is that the kind of mindset you're seeing?
I think it's quite varied. We do a lot of family work, so we work with the family. We've realised that just working within the school walls or within a young person one-to-one can have a small impact, but the real long-lasting, sustainable impact is working with the families. I think if the family have good habits, good routines, that makes a massive impact and there's a little bit of drive. But the problem is, a lot of the time, the lack of ambition, I suppose, comes from learnt behaviour.
Yeah.
We're working with a young person in the Clacton area at the moment who's third generation unemployed. So they've never known anyone in their family to work. So for them, they kind of have no real need to work to get a driving licence and all that sort of stuff because their life at the moment doesn't require that. I think we see your inner city duckers and divers have probably got a bit more ambition. They want that nice car, they want the nice watch, they want the trainers, whatever it might be. So as long as they can do that in the right way, that's good. I think a lot of the time we're seeing now with kids that are getting involved in criminality is because they know they don't have any links to people that run businesses. They've not really been brought up in a way that tells them to go drop their CV in a shop. It's, I'm going to go out and I'm going to steal, or I'm going to sell drugs, or I'm going to look after something for someone. And that's where that real unhealthy and dangerous cycle really starts, I suppose.
It's interesting what you said about the expression of Essex, because prior to the 60s, it always had a good name. And it's where the original capital was. There's a load of history there, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I heard, I was with an actress, she was probably in her 70s, and she said that she used to go to a club called Tramps.
Right.
And in there, that there was always like lords and earls and whatever, and they had a few interesting evenings. And apparently one of the wives was so angry about what was going on that she did a whole push in the papers about what Essex girls are like and how they behave. And that was the first staining of people from there, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, that does stick, doesn't it? And it's probably not so much the case now. It's probably a nationwide thing with certain walks of life. But I think, there is definitely a reputation or stereotype to certain parts of Essex. I mean, I can't go anywhere abroad without someone telling me to shut up because that's what they've heard on TV throughout the Only Ways Essex or whatever it might be. That's kind of, that sticks. But I think once you actually spend a bit more time in Essex, you realise how different it is to what you really expect. There are some massively affluent areas.
Yeah.
I'm quite proud to bring my children up in quite a nice area now, and for obvious reasons, because of the way the world is at the moment.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose, where I talk about that, where we're seeing more kids, I don't think there's potentially more kids that are struggling in school. I think that the world's just changing so fast that the families and the schools and everything else just can't keep up.
Yeah.
I don't think kids can do now what we used to do. I used to go into London quite regularly with my mates in my early teenage years. There's no way I'd let my 13-year-old son get a train into London now because it's not safe. So they're experiencing less of life, but they've got access to more life through their phones and technology. And
that's where the big gap is, isn't it? Because you lose social skills. It's easy to look at someone online, like asking a girl out for a date or going somewhere, but you miss that interaction. It takes a lot of thought process, a lot of energy, possible rejection in real life, conversations with friends, oh, that didn't work out. And I guess you lose your resilience, don't you, to life skills, right?
Yeah, 100%. And that's kind of what we look for in our mentoring and our projects, is to try and expose them to some, not hardship, but situations where they've got to think on their feet a little bit. Personally, having worked in sport for so long, I think the best coaches are the ones that allow their athlete to think for themselves in the moment and actually make decisions. So little things that we might do with young people as basic as just sending a letter they've never done before, which is second nature to us. Little things just like going to pay with cash and getting the right change and understanding what they should be given back. I think those are the sort of life skills that make a huge difference to a young person that probably get overlooked by everyone in society now.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, in 10 years' time, stamps probably won't even exist. But if we look at it in that way, I think that, there's little things we can teach our children and the young people we work with in particular. We try and expose them to different things.
But that's really important because you see kids going, I don't know, if you go to a coffee shop, just tap, take your coffee and go. And there's no conversation. Even the barrister sometimes just is like, there's your coffee.
Yeah.
And it's the little nuances that's missing, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I try it. We work on a relationship model, but I try and be that role model that will talk to people when we're out with kids. So if we're walking along, I might just go up to someone and say, do you mind if I stroke your dog? just to show them that actually it's okay to talk to people. It's not dangerous as long as you do it in the right way. Obviously, the Stranger Danger thing still exists, but at the same time, is reading someone's body language and understanding when they're safe to approach. And when you walk past someone that might be fishing on a river or a lake and going, oh, how are you, mate? Have you caught anything today? And that might change someone's day because they might have not spoke to anyone all day or all week because we are so isolated now if we're not connected through technology. And just showing young people that it's all right to smile at people and have a conversation and be nice. And that, for me, makes a huge impact on these young people because they start treating their friends a little bit better. They start being a bit more respectful to teachers because they realise, actually, shaking someone's hand and going, hi, Paul, how are you, mate? How's things been? Goes a long way. So it's not all the technical methodologies all the time that we do use. Sometimes it's just being a good role model.
But that's really... this is the point. It's, you know... I coach people as well, and it's sure there's amazing formulas to put in place and big things, but I think it's the nuances, and I think it's the connection. I literally think it's just the connection to people, and I love what you're doing because that's thinking outside of the box, right? That's using real human skills that's easy to be looked over because, like you said, it's like looking at all the big stuff all the time and just a little bit of communication. I lived in LA for a long time, and my acting coach there, he used to make me walk the streets for an hour and a half, right? No one walks the streets over there. And we'd just read and do silly stuff to get over things. And he'd be like, the first time I worked with him, he said, I've noticed something about you. I said, what's that? He said, you don't say hello to anybody. Yeah. He said, so for the next 6 months, you're going to say hello to everybody in the street. I'm like, well, everybody. He said, everybody. And it was so weird. I literally had to say, hi, how you doing? Hi, how you doing? To anybody and everybody. And it was the best thing ever done because it just broke this weird energy that, be it I don't want to disturb them or I feel uncomfortable talking to them. So you introducing kids to doing stuff like that, I think it's a brilliant technique.
Yeah, and it does work because I do think, like, I worked in Wales at a residential centre for a year and everyone says hello to each other. You're up on the mountain, middle of nowhere, rain pouring down, and people stop and have a conversation with you. I think it's similar up north. People generally are more friendly, aren't they? Whereas you walk around London, you're lucky to get an eye contact, let alone
bigger cities are tougher.
So, I don't know, just little things we try and implement in our processes with young people that hopefully make a bit of a difference to their character more than anything. That it's nice to be nice. And
how long do you get an opportunity to work with, say, an individual?
It depends really on the severity of the referral. So we do a referral process. So a school or an agency, local authority will refer a young person to us. It might be a case that they just need some short-term work to try and re-engage them in school. So we would typically do sort of anything between 4 and 8 hours a week with them on a one-to-one basis for half a term, or it could be a term.
Is this in-term time?
Yeah, so in-term time, yeah. So... during the school hours. So if a young person's got a diagnosis of, let's say, ADHD or autism, they'll typically have some funding attached to their educational healthcare plan. And that allows them to get some sort of alternate provision to allow them to access education appropriately. There's different bands of funding. So typically the young people we get referred are a higher band of funding because the lower bands barely pays for them to do anything. But the system, it kind of works. There is a huge lack of funding in education at the moment. We're seeing schools cut back constantly. They really are cutting back, and we're seeing so many young people miss out on opportunities because of that.
That must be a compound effect that once you're facing a direction, like away from school, away from the system, that must just be compound that it just gets bigger and worse, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's why we believe in early intervention, being able to get it just before, we nip it in the bud, I suppose, before it gets too bad. Because what we see is you get a young person that can't access education in a positive way, so they start misbehaving because that's a defence mechanism. They start mucking around in class because they can't access the work that the teacher's giving them. So they'll start mucking around, then they end up getting suspended, and then they end up with long-term suspension. So that rather than being in school, they're hanging around on the streets all day, or they're sat on their Xbox or whatever it might be during the day, and they're not getting... The most important thing about school for me is social interaction. So learning how to deal with different types of people in life. And they're not getting that because they're sat at home and they're given a bit of online learning or whatever it might be. And we see it all the time. And these young people are losing that drive a little bit because they are stuck at home so much and they start hanging around with other kids that are off school that potentially aren't the best behaved. So early intervention for us works. So catching them that sort of year 7, year 8, early secondary school to really try and make long-lasting change to their behaviour, their mindset, and we look at emotional regulation as well. So if I'm starting to feel angry, how do I put the brakes on and then do something that's positive as opposed to flipping the table and chucking something across the room?
And how does that work? Because emotions are huge, especially at that age, aren't they?
Yeah, and we're honest. You're not going to crack it all the time. Mm. Sometimes it clicks. A lot of times it's about having the right member of staff, working with the right kid. So we've got someone like myself, I deal with crisis very well. So I'm very good at coming in at the late stage where it's really gone wrong because I'm quite a calm person.
But you're a big physical male as well, aren't
yeah,
you?
So exactly. So I work with the sort of more high-end kids where it has gone all wrong or it's about to. But that doesn't say I won't work with every young person because that's about developing your skill set. But I've got a guy that works for me, Kyle, who's fantastic. He's one of the hardest working people that I've ever met. Really, really great. And he's really good with those sort of low-level autistic kids that are just a little bit shy or introverted, struggling with school because it's too noisy, it's too overwhelming. And he's really good at taking them into situations in the community where it is a little bit louder and gradually building that up to the point that a school dinner hall is more manageable.
Kind of like CBT.
Yeah, very similar to that. Yeah, so we use elements of CBT. We use elements of sort of sports psychology, I suppose, as well. But yeah, getting that member of staff right is so important. And probably employment is our biggest challenge as an organisation. I think we've seen that there's a generational thing at the moment where people don't want to work as hard as we have.
Yeah.
But there's also an element of, that doesn't sound like a bit of me because I can earn more money in recruitment in the city and go out and have a great time with my mates on a Thursday night. We can't pay the sort of money that the big organisations are paying, but at the same time, we train our staff up to a point that they can go on and do whatever they want. So I think when they start going in that direction and they're going off, it's about catching them just before it goes too far.
Yeah.
Because once it spirals, it's very difficult to come back in.
And do you use what... Because you have a history of boxing and stuff. Yeah. Do you implement that as well into helping the kids?
I think that was probably my biggest strength and biggest downfall, really, when I took over the organisation, because I used my strengths, which is coaching boxing, and my links within the boxing community, I suppose. But very quickly, we started getting known as a boxing organisation because we'd take these rough, tough kids that had been kicked out of school, we'd get them in the gym, turn a majority of their lives around, get them back on track. And actually we're bigger than that and we're more than that. So for us, it's been kind of trying to steer away from just boxing and diversify a little bit more. Don't get me wrong, I still use boxing all the time. I've not met a kid I can't engage yet with boxing because it's so personal. You've got to be concentrating, you've got to be switched on, and the level of eye contact and communication within boxing, it is, you can't replicate that in a lot of sports.
So I know that because I've boxed for years.
Yeah.
And it, as a young man, it was a real safe place to go to. For those who don't know, a lot of people can look at boxing as violence and stuff. In my personal experience, it's the complete opposite. It's a skill, it's humility.
Yeah.
It's one-on-one battle with someone else with respect. How does that work for the kids that you take in? Are they surprised at what it is?
Yeah, I think the biggest barrier for us getting young people involved in boxing to start with is generally the parents' perception of boxing or the school's perception of boxing. They, exactly as you just said, see it as violent, barbaric, various other buzzwords you could chuck around it, but actually it's completely opposite. You'll find that majority of people, including yourself, that have been involved in some sort of combat sport, whether it be boxing, jiu-jitsu, kickboxing, Muay Thai, they're generally the nicest people you ever met because that ego is left at the door. That bravado and anxiety around being in danger goes a lot of the time as well. And their stress response changes a little bit. They become a lot more relaxed in difficult situations. I know for a fact that I'm more confident as a person having had a boxing background, and that's constantly developing as well with coaching. You can go into a boxing gym and you'll have criminals, you have police officers, millionaires, people that are struggling to pay their rent. You have all walks of life, which you don't get in many other sports.
And I love what you said because you do leave it at the door.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. When I was competing, outside of the gym, I was at my calmest and coolest, not in a cocky way, but I just felt very relaxed. I realised how much effort you have to put in, how much skill other people have. And it takes a lot of fear away, doesn't it? Like what you said.
Yeah, 100%. And I think we see a lot of young people that potentially might be very introverted, very nervous young people struggling with anxiety. I know anxiety is a word that's chucked around a lot, but actually there are a lot of young people that are suffering with anxiety at the moment because of COVID, and they have other various reasons, but a lot of it comes back to that interpersonal skills that we spoke about. They're not exposed to as much now. So a boxing club where they realise that actually they're not made out of glass, they can look after themselves, and actually violence is the last resort. I have been involved in a sport a long time, and I've never started a fight in my life, and never would want to, because actually I realise, what's the point? Do you know what I mean? If I go turn up to a school with a black eye, there's no good to anything coming out of that. So
it's not the best look.
No, exactly. Yeah, so I think 100% for me. So I think, like, we see kids transition in a way where they become more relaxed, and they become more focused as well, because they know that they can release all those emotions that we spoke about. They can go and hit a bag, they can do pads, they can do a bit of sparring. And don't get me wrong, all the stuff we do with the kids in our projects is non-contact. So at no point are they going to get hurt. And actually, I would say boxing, compared to something like rugby, there's probably 1% of the injuries.
Yeah.
You might, in all the years being involved in it, you might have a bust lip or a black eye or something like that, but that's at the top, the higher level.
Well, when you're a good trainer, you're teaching people defence most of the time, aren't you?
Yeah, 100%.
And a lot of the work is not, it's on a bag or jumping rope or being fit around the actual...
Yeah, and I think, obviously, I big boxing up a lot because I love the sport, so I'm passionate about it. But for me, any sort of physical activity is good for young people, or anyone of any age, really. You never leave the gym feeling worse. I know it's a bit of a stereotype, but you do. You do feel better afterwards. It's as good for that as it is your body. And for me, that's so important that we can encourage young people to live a healthy lifestyle where they are active. So it might be that the young person takes no interest in boxing, but we can encourage them to walk their dog every morning before they go to school, just to get that time by themselves and relax a little bit. It might be just putting better patterns in place so that they get a better night's sleep. So by exercising, if you've got a hyperactive kid, they're generally going to sleep better if they've done some form of exercise.
Yeah.
If they're sat in front of the TV eating rubbish, chances are they're not going to sleep great. They go to bed and they're on their phone, the blue light and all that sort of stuff, the brain stimulated. So we look at a healthy lifestyle with physical activity, but also those little habits that you can put in place as a parent, coming back to that family work, is what can I do for my young person? Can I get them to have dinner a little bit earlier rather than having it at 9 o'clock just before they go to bed?
And do the parents engage in it? Like, if you're someone who's like second or third generation?
Yeah, it is 50-50. It is really. It's probably the most challenging part of our work. I've done it so long now, I find it a lot easier, because I find having difficult conversations quite easy. So
that's a special skill in itself.
yeah, definitely. And that comes over time, doesn't it, with maturity, I suppose. I'm older than my staff, which they remind me of.
You're still young. How old are you now, Tom?
32, yeah.
Beautiful age.
Going on 50. But it's generally, for me, I look at it and I think, like, if we can implement little bits in the home around sleep, around food, just around physical activity, doing stuff as a family as well, can have a huge impact. I love doing stuff with my kids. I work a lot, and I run down the boxing gym a lot. But if I get any opportunity, I want to do something with my kids. I don't want to be sat there watching Peppa Pig all day. I want to be out with my kids in the woods, or taking them somewhere to experience something. And for me, if you can pass that a little bit on to the families, you see a huge impact.
With our family, we're the same. We try and do that stuff as most as possible. Just get the kids dirty. They're like, can we get dirty? I'm like, yeah. Jump in. Let's just play around. And the difference we noticed is, if my wife and I have been really busy and we're tired, we're like, yeah, let's watch, like, have a movie afternoon. Sure, the kids watch stuff, but then they start to get fidgety and a little irritated and a little bored after a certain time. But if we go out in the forest or take the dog for a walk, and I know it's difficult because, you know, if you're an inner city kid and family and you're in a high rise, that's different. But you can still get out but engage with the children, right, personally. So it takes a lot of energy as a parent, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, talking about those inner city club kids there, I think that's why grassroots sport is so important to those young people, because their opportunity for that outlet comes from a volunteer football coach. It comes from those opportunities where we're seeing youth clubs disappear now, aren't we? Whereas when we were younger, there was youth clubs on most corners.
I'm just going to say, I love you say we when we're younger. I'm 20 years old. You look younger. Thank you.
But yeah, no, for me, and I just see these opportunities for young people now and what's the drive to be a volunteer now?
Yeah.
I've been a volunteer for a long time and I love it, because that's my way of staying involved in the sport that I love. But also seeing those young people develop, and you've done it off your own back, it is fantastic.
That's the thing about, so there's an external reward, which is mostly, you know, a car, watch, whatever people look at. But as a human being, that can leave you empty compared to an internal reward, right, of actually seeing that you've helped someone change their life.
Yeah, and I've had people come up to me in supermarkets that I coached when they were 10 years old and they're now early 20s and they've got a child on the way or something like that. And you sit there and think, like, they've got a good job, they've got a car, they've got a roof over their head and all that sort of stuff. And if you look back when they were probably in their early teens, you thought, this is only going one way.
Yeah.
And it's prison or death. And as awful as that sounds, but that's the reality with some of these kids that walk through a boxing gym door. And we love to think we're a very inclusive club. So I run Rain Boxing Club, which is in Braintree near Chelmsford in Essex. I've been there for just over 10 years now. The club's been in existence for 15. And we're not a top-level club by any stretch of imagination. We're not producing national European champions and all that. But what we do provide is a safe space for young people where they can better themselves physically, emotionally and mentally. And what they do is 9 times out of 10 leave that gym a better person when they decide to stop boxing. Yeah. And we have all walks of life. Obviously, it is a... It's not a very diverse area, but we have every aspect of that area we get through our gym. Mm. And we're quite humble with it, I suppose, as well. Like, we do a lot of good work in the community as a club, all of our backs. So there's 5 of us coaches there that do everything for nothing. And for us, like, I look at the amount of hours that we've put in over the years and think, so the lead coach, the chairman of the club, Jack's been doing it for 15 years. He's amazing. And he's cost him money, if anything, never taken a penny out of the club, and he's a really top guy. And they're the sort of local people you need to bring that community through.
Yeah.
And I look at where I live now, there's a youth club that my son goes to on a Friday evening. It's run by 2 83-year-olds, and they've been doing it for 60 years.
Wow.
And they're up for an award this year, and I think, like, that's amazing. Like,
see, this is the humanity that I was fortunate enough to have a youth club and probably didn't respect the people who run it as much because I took it for granted at the time. But the effort that people put in that gets unspoken about, unseen, they're not there for applause and money, is just so, it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Because it's a lot of effort and a lot of time.
Yeah, you miss out on a lot. And I think for me, I've taken a bit of a step back in the last couple of years to spend a bit more time with my own family because I realised that I was neglecting them a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was only when my little girl, who's 5 now, she was 3 at the time, she goes, "Oh, you're going to boxing again, Daddy?" And you sit there and think, oh, you feel so guilty. Do you know what I mean? Don't get wrong, in 2 years' time, she'll be in the gym with me, so I won't have to worry about it so much. But for me, I look at it and I think, like, yeah, these people are giving up a lot of their time, missing out on birthdays. I remember going to the national finals in Newcastle a couple of years, talking to a coach there, and he was missing his son's wedding to take a kid to the national final. Man. And you sit there and think, that should be one of your proudest days of your life. So you could think of that in 2 ways. You could think, he's a bit of a knob for missing the wedding. Yeah. But in another time, actually, that kid had no one else to take him to the national final, and he's earned that opportunity to be national champion.
Yeah. It's incredible. It is 2 ways of looking at it. But there is a stoicness about that. In my club I used to go to, was in Howard Wood, and my old trainer was Roy. He's a little bit like the guy out of the Rocky film, like really small, croaky voice. Yeah.
Yeah, I know Roy, yeah.
Do you know Roy? Passed away. Didn't know now, Roy? Really?
Yeah.
So Roy was, I was really close to Roy.
Mm.
And I remember when he bought it, it's probably ages ago, I'm a car person, I remember when he bought his, he had a Mark III Escort on an X-Play that we used to drive around in. I remember fighting I had quite a lot of anxiety as a kid, and I remember fighting for the British title. And I remember before I got in the ring, he said to me, "You're not going to outbox this kid. He's had 64 fights, you had 7. But you can beat him if you fight him properly."
Yeah.
And I loved him because he was so honest, so grounded, as you know, and just a good guy, like genuinely a good guy. He'd walk up with his cane, come in there, and it'd be hard with you, but fair and firm, right?
Yeah, and I think that generation of people's gone now, unfortunately. Mm. So, like, Roy at Alma was an unbelievable guy. And
did you go to Alma then?
No, I knew of it. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so, and then you had, because everyone within the boxing community knows each other.
Yeah,
he's one of the best things and the worst things.
And Martin as well, right?
Yeah. So Martin, he does our trophies now for our show. So
no
way. He's got a shop in Chelmsford. Really good guy, Martin.
He's lovely, Martin.
Yeah, so, you know, really good guy. I'll get him to say hello to you. I'll give him.
Yeah, please do. What's the club? Because he did a little club for a while, didn't he?
He was down at Chelmsford for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, really, they're all great guys, and that generation, unfortunately, is kind of disappearing. I was having this conversation with Kevin Mitchell the other day, who was a world challenger. He's opening a gym in Upminster, so it's going to be the first amateur boxing club in Upminster. And he remembers that his old coach, Mickey May, giving him a job because he said, "No, you're not going to sell that on the street like you are at the moment," because he was selling a bit of weed or whatever he was doing. He's going, "Listen, you're coming with me and you're going to come work." And it was someone like that just went, this is going to cost me money, but I want to get you off the street because I see the potential in you. And unfortunately, that generation is disappearing a little bit. I'm very lucky to know some great people in boxing. I've got mentors that I still use now that I'll ring for advice, like Sab Leo at Leo's Gym. Sab's an old school Italian gentleman, but he says it as it is, and that's what I need sometimes. Yeah. And he's been a great sounding board for me, and he's one of sort of that generation. He's not that old, actually, because he'll kill me for saying that.
He's probably my age, isn't he?
I don't know how old he is, actually. It's hard to tell. But he, no, genuinely, really good guy. And I'm very fortunate that I've got that sort of network of people. And it's helped me in business as well, because we've now sort of seen... So we work a lot with Active Essex Foundation, who are a big funder for crime prevention and mental health funding. We're just linking in with them with the mental health funding for the first time. We're going to run a boxing program, which is an hour of boxing, half an hour of conversations around mental health.
Is that at your gym?
It'll be at four different gyms across Essex.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
So it's quite a big pot of funding that we're accessing. But the idea being that we're going to get young people in that transitional age between 17 to 25. So it'll be young men that are overlooked from a mental health standpoint, that we're seeing them take their life all the time. We're seeing them struggle with mental health in the background, and then it catches up with them in later life. So that's what we're targeting at the moment, is that sort of that bracket of 17 to 25 of young men, really.
Do you know what? It's really interesting, because there's so much conversation about diversity and other things, which I get. But I do believe, in my experience as well, that young men are really looked over and lost. And there is suicide rates are so high. I know kids have taken their lives and stuff. Partly because they can't talk to anyone. They don't think they can talk to anyone. The narrative has been for quite some time that if you're, say, a boxer or a, you know, a white guy, whatever, that you're a brute or you're a thug or whatever. And there's a real, you know, and there's a hard, it's like you can't talk to girls anymore because they don't know if they're going to get offend them or what they're going to say. And it's really difficult.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that impact on mental health for youngsters too?
Yeah, I mean, mental health for me is a big thing. I've got a real passion for supporting people that are struggling. I just suffered with mental health really badly. I was involved in a car accident at 18, life-changing injuries, was in a really bad way, but I lost everything. So sport, the lot at that point, I had to move back in with my mum, and I was bedbound for God knows how long, operation after operation. And I got to the point where I started working again. I had no purpose whatsoever. I'd taken the first job I could find in a factory, and I'd gone from feeling like a superhero to feeling really rubbish about myself.
Because you were successful at
boxing and football, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was playing football at a decent level, and I was a decent boxer as well. So for me, it was a real eye-opener to actually, like, you've just lost that overnight. Really.
Yeah.
And
that's a massive trauma, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I got to the point where I dealt with trauma previously. So my dad was an alcoholic, so I dealt with that as a kid. He's virtually like not having a dad, to be honest with you. But I think this was the hardest thing that ever hit me. And I got to the point where I was suicidal. I did try and take my own life. And I look back on it now and think, what were you doing? You should have just asked for help. I'm really close to my mum, but I didn't feel like I wanted to burden her with it.
That's the key though, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I've had a conversation with her since, like as a parent myself now, and had a conversation with her, and she's just like, you could always talk to me about anything. And my mum knew everything about me as a kid, probably too much, to be honest with you. And she was my partner in crime in many ways. And for me, I think when I went through that and I look back at it now and I think, like, I learned so much from that experience that I hope that I can give to other people.
Yeah.
And I see so many young men now bottling it up because they want to be that tough guy, that brute you spoke about then. And actually, there's no shame in going and saying I need help. And I did that a year afterwards, really, and got that help.
Where did you go? Because you went into a factory because what, you just was going to work
money.
For money?
I was skint. I was in my overdraft. I was absolutely broke. And fortunately, my life wasn't expensive at the time because, like I say, I was living at home with my mum. But I was in a really bad way financially, emotionally. I was getting into bad habits. So I'd gone from being around people that were athletes, I'd gone from being with people that were successful, positive people, to hanging around with my mates that were just spending the whole time down the local pub.
Yeah.
And I was there from Friday to Sunday every week because I was so bored at home because I couldn't drive. I had my arm in a cast. I could barely walk. And I was like, my mate used to pick me up and take me down the pub. And I was just, that was my opportunity for socialising. And I saw it as a great thing at the time because I was out with the lads. Do you know what I mean? I was a young lad, they're all older than
got
me.
Got your own chauffeur.
Yeah, exactly. Picked up in his little Renault Clio. And it was, but for me, I was like, I couldn't see any danger in it. But I got to the point where I was putting on weight. I was drinking far too much. I didn't have a problem or anything, but I was really at a point where I was just, everything was negative. And then I got back into work and I went, I'm going to get myself fit again and start having some sort of outlet. And hopefully now with our projects that we're running around mental health that will be starting in February, we can have a real impact on those young men that I was that age. And like you said about being anxious when you're younger, probably similar sort of age. And I think that 17 to 25 year old where you're trying to become a man, you're trying to become an adult and take responsibility for your own life is really difficult. And it's probably as hard now, if not harder.
It's so difficult because there's so many questions. What job do I do with the pressure of social media now? Because it seems everyone's got a Range Rover or a Bentley, which is so wrong. Most of them are probably on hire for 5 minutes to take a picture anyway.
Yeah.
As you get older, you realise that. I remember in the financial crash, I was like, where's all the Mercs and the BMs and all the cars gone? And a friend of mine was like, everyone leases. I was like, I thought that was just an American thing. I thought you'd just buy what you can earn.
Yeah.
And I think that big illusion's really bad and dangerous for people, right? So when you're 17, what do you do? If you don't have the education to go into the city or be a lawyer, if that's not your thing, then you're probably looking at crime or whatever, aren't you? So it is a tough window.
Yeah, and that expectation now on people to have certain things. We're living in a very material world now, aren't we? And it probably is unhealthy in many ways. And I'm quite a simplistic person, if I'm honest, but I wasn't when I was younger. I wanted all that stuff. I still want it.
Well, it's natural to want stuff.
Yeah, but I think, especially when you have children and you start opening your eyes to the world, it becomes less of a priority, I suppose.
Yeah.
You start realising actually having a nice house is a lot better than having a nice car.
For sure.
So you look at it in that way, it's slightly different. But I think, the pressure on young men now is crazy. It's ridiculous. Unattainable for a lot of people as well. But I always think, don't limit yourself. Like, just because you haven't got that education. I use my brother, for example. Like, my brother's dyslexic, really struggles to read and write, but he's got a huge building firm that he's got loads of guys working for him that are probably the people that used to take the mick out of him at school. And he's earning really good money, he's got a great life, he's enjoying himself. And actually, he's a prime example of what we're trying to achieve with these young people, is don't let your diagnosis or don't let what your teacher's told you limit you.
I mean, if you have ADHD and dyslexia, which I have dyslexia, you have super skills of thinking outside the box, and you can see the cracks that people can't see. And if you can have someone to nourish that area, like your brother, he's probably a brilliant builder because you can do things practically, which someone who's academic can't do. Yeah, and you can do really well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when I started getting myself fit again after my accident, I decided I was going to join the military. That was how can I reach the peak performance without going back into the sport that I couldn't access anymore? So I went to go into the military, passed everything, and I was super fit. Got back to almost like my peak boxing fitness, really. And I didn't get through the medical, but I passed everything else. And I'd never lose my temper, but I completely lost my temper that day because saying, listen, I would be a great soldier. I'd be able to do this. But you're not letting me in because I've got a metal arm, I've got metal on my leg, I've got all this sort of stuff. And I get it now, it is what it is, but I sit there and I was really downbeat at the time.
Oh, that must have been so frustrating to train all the way up to that point.
Yeah, and I was running sub 25Ks, I could do 150 push-ups on the bounce track. Wow. I was absolutely flying. And then for them to turn around and say, no, because of your body, you can't be in. I'm like, what's wrong with my body? And that was sort of a reminder of like what these kids are going through at school is actually the limitations that are being put on them.
Yeah.
And we hear it all the time. And sometimes that doesn't even come from the school. It comes from the home. Like, we're working with a young person at the moment and I've never met a parent, I won't go into too much detail obviously, but I've never met a parent that's so degrading of their own child. He can't do that because he's got autism. He can't come to the boxing club because he's got autism. It's constantly that autism word's chucked around. But actually, that kid is phenomenal. He's one of the most friendly young people I've ever met. Physically, so capable, strong as an ox. And his mum's going, no, you can't go to football to join a football team because everyone will take the mick out of you. And I sit there sometimes and think, like, just give him the chance. Yeah. You never know, he might surprise you. You look at Tom Stoltman, 3 times world's strongest man, has got autism. And it's just, like, there is no boundaries in life apart from the ones you put on yourself or other people put on you.
That's the problem when you're younger, though, and you've got a parent who, my mum, bless her, she'd say, if you don't do this, you won't be able to get that, and, like, you won't be able to work in the city. And I always thought, I don't actually want to work in the city.
Yeah.
But that constant messaging will affect you completely.
That old saying, if you hear something enough, you start believing it, is true. Yeah. And that does happen. But I think that mindset can be broken sometimes. So I'll give you an example. We're working with a young girl on a project at the moment. She's 17 years old. Obviously, I can't go into too much detail. But she's had to flee her family up north to come down south. And she's the most positive person I've ever met. And she said something to me the other day that was just profound. And it actually made me stop and think. And there's not many people I meet when I'm out on sessions now that actually do that. And she's essentially, there's a lot of domestic violence in the household on her, from her dad and stepmom. And she came down here to get away from it. She made herself homeless, essentially. So she's been put in sort of supported living. And she turned around to me and she said, I came from two parents that were immigrants that were fiercely religious. And I'm the queer kid with special needs. I was never going to fit in. And I sat there and went, what a great outlook.
Good for her,
and she's now got herself a job. She's going to university to study maths.
Wow.
She's doing all these amazing things. And you think, actually, that made me take a step back and go, actually, like, if you can be so positive, having been through what you've been through, I wish I could just take a little bit of that and give it to some of the kids that we work with, or some of the people that I know in life, because actually she's just like, yeah, it is what it is, the sort of thing.
You get them people, don't you, just say stuff and you're like, wow.
Yeah, 100%. And I've actually said to her, I said, if your degree doesn't work out, come work for me, because you could teach these kids so much just with your mindset and your attitude. And I think it's fantastic. And she said things before, she's told me a lot about her life, and it puts a tear in your eye. And then she says something like that, and you go, actually, you're right. Like, you've done what you needed to do to give yourself a better life. And brave of her to do it. She's put herself out on the street, and she's going to do really well in life just because of the way she talks and the confidence she's built in herself. What she said, I was just like, wow.
Who did you ask for help for?
Mental health? Or?
No, after you said your accident and you said you asked for help.
So I went to the GP to say that I had, I just didn't want to be here anymore, basically. And I was really struggling to get out of bed in the morning. I was struggling to motivate myself. And they basically turned around and said, call this number, they do counselling. And I called them up and it was a 6-month waiting list. I didn't have any money to pay for private counselling or anything. So I just sort of started, I suppose, talking to people that I could rely on. So I started spending time with better people rather than just being down the pub with my mates. And then I randomly just started speaking to someone in the boxing world again. And he was running Rain Boxing Club. So Jack, I spoke to earlier, said, why don't you come do a bit of coaching? And that was probably the best thing for me, because it gave me that purpose again. I was seeing kids develop. I was being surrounded by positive people all the time. And that for me, I don't want to say it, but I wouldn't be the person I am now if it wasn't for that boxing club. They've become an extended part of my family, I suppose, in many ways. And the kids I treat like my own. My son tells me that all the time. You're nicer to him than you are me. He's a good little boxer, my lad. But he's generally like, oh, you turn around to that kid and said he'd done really well, but you told me I was rubbish. And I said, yeah, but I'm always going to be higher than you on you, because I want more from you. Do you know what I mean? And so, I was very fortunate to stumble across that opportunity within the boxing club. And since then, has excelled me to work. I worked for England Boxing for a long time. So I was with the national governing body. Got to see some great places, do some great things. And it's kind of all led me to this point with the organisation, which I'm very proud of, actually.
Should be. It's amazing work. Yeah. It's really nice to hear, because I think, you know, when you have a lot of adversity in life, it can go one way or the other. But I think, it's so nice to hear that you've done what that girl's done.
Yeah.
You've took everything and turned it into an asset, and now you're using it, because you know, once you've... It's like a race driver. Once you've driven the track, you can teach anyone, because you know the downfalls, the upsides, what tyres you're supposed to have, how fast you're supposed to go. And it's the same with life, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think I like to think that when I take on a member of staff, I want them to come with that little bit of lived experience, because they're going to be able to give a little bit more to those young people that they're working with. All the members of staff I've had have gone through something or struggled at school or whatever it might be, so they can empathise with that young person and sort of really connect with them, because without relationship connection, you're never going to be able to coach someone. That's my personal opinion. They need to buy into you as a person, and they need to trust you as well. And if you can open up a little bit, you don't want to give too much, but open up a little bit about what you've been through or the lessons you've learned in life, I think you can really take someone a lot further than someone that's just reading out a textbook.
Well, because you build trust. There's a human thing where you build trust. Don't get me started, but this is what the government needs to realise. When you've been through something and you can teach someone, like the boxing club, like the boxing world, there's a natural respect there because you believe what someone's saying because you know they've already trained and been in the ring. So they must know, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I was watching the boxing in Monaco on Saturday night. Unfortunately, I wasn't there, but I was watching it on the TV at home. And I watched towards the later rounds, Conor Walker beat Pat McCormack. And I'm watching the two coaches, and Jamie Moore's been there and done everything in the boxing world. And you could see the way he was connecting with his boxer in the corner. And that's a prime example. I look at when we take on a young person, the first thing I do, we do an initial meeting with that young person. We want to meet the parents, carers, because I want to see what they're really like straight away. I want to see how they respond to their parent. I want to see how they respond to their teachers, because we need to build a bigger picture of that young person before we start working with them. Because we get a referral form through and you'll read the piece of paper and you think, Christ, this kid's a nightmare. He's done this, he's done that. But actually, you take him out of that classroom environment and you meet him with the parents and all that sort of stuff, and it'd be the sweetest kid you've ever met. And then you start giving them opportunities, whether it be through courses, through qualifications, through just little life skills we spoke about earlier. I think really it is, you see a different side to them and you understand that actually we need to give them the coping mechanisms to deal with it in a classroom, because they're fine when they're out with us. But actually in a classroom, it's too noisy. They can't access the work or whatever it might be. And don't get wrong, we're not just preparing kids for school. We're preparing them for life afterwards as well.
Yeah. Not mentioning any names, but have you got one young person that you've seen go from a really bad situation to an incredible situation?
Yes. Unfortunately, it doesn't always happen. We've had a young person that we really turned around. Like, they were doing amazing. Their backstory, I can't go into it, unfortunately, but their backstory was something that you wouldn't wish upon your worst enemy. Really made your heart sink when they told you about it and when you heard about it through social workers and various things. And we were really on a good track. And then something happened and then it changed. And they've gone back to not quite where they were, but they've gone back to a sort of a not a very good situation that was out of our control. I suppose a good example would be some of the young offenders we work with. So through a referral system, we do the Sports and Life Skills program, which is basically a young offender that might be on tag or they're just been criminally convicted for the first time. They'll come to us and they'll do a 12-week one-to-one program where they'll do some sort of sport attached to mentoring. Sometimes it's longer than 12 weeks, but we feel like if we can't make an impact in 12 weeks, we're not going to make any difference further down the line. Yeah. It's that sort of humility to it, I suppose. So we had a young person that came to us, been moved out of London into Essex, involved in some really nasty stuff with drugs in London, come to Essex to live with his mum, and the young lad's incredible. I tried to keep him at the boxing club because I think he could be the next Anthony Joshua. He's about 6'6", big, strong lad, but he decided that he wants to go back to football, which is great. And he's really turned his life around. He's staying away from criminality. Amazing. He's got a part-time job and he's doing college as well. So for us, that was a real success story. Yeah. And that was only with our 12-week program as well, like the long-term mentor, and we see improvements all the time. So we're seeing kids that have been off school for a year due to either suspensions or they just didn't have the courage to go into school because they didn't have that support at home. And we're now seeing them in school full time. And we go into school to work with the other kids and we're seeing them and they come up, Tom, how are you, mate? And all this sort of stuff. Guess what? I did this in English or I did that. And that brings a smile to your face because you think, actually, look, this kid's getting the education they deserve now.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the time, and it sounds awful, I've got to be a little bit careful what I say, but I think sometimes with these kids, the school don't mind them not being there because it's easier. They haven't got the disruption to the other kids. They haven't got the foul language. They haven't got all this sort of stuff. So the long-term suspension works for them. They stick them on an online platform where they'll do an hour of maths and an hour of English every day. And it was funny because we worked with a young person. I went to his house. He'd not been to school for 9 months because he'd been suspended. He was racially abused in the school and turned around and punched the kid. And he was the one that was punished in the school.
Yeah.
And his mum was like, I don't think he can ever go back to school. Like, his behaviour is quite bad and everything. But he really likes his online learning. I said, oh, what's he doing now? And he's on his online learning upstairs. I went upstairs and he's got his online learning there and he's playing GTA on his Xbox like that. Because he realised that he didn't actually have to engage in that online lesson. Yeah. It was just a tick box for attendance, really. So he sat there playing on his PlayStation while the lesson's going on. I'm like, oh, what have you learned in your online? He goes, absolutely nothing. Yeah. Because he was making that choice because he realised. But he's now back in school full time, doing really well, behaving himself and all that sort of stuff. So we are making a difference, I like to think. There's a long way to go yet. We're still a baby, we're still small, but hopefully connecting with other organisations, connecting with people like yourself, I do see it being something that could be really huge in the long term.
Tom, thanks for coming on This Is Powerful. You're doing brilliant work. We'll leave all email addresses and stuff and information for anyone who's listening.
Thanks, buddy. Cheers. No, thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Mate. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefoot and at this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eberlong, who does all the hard work in the background, and the rest of the team.